Welcome back to the Amber May Show. I am so glad you are here with me today. I have such a heartfelt show today. It's a sad show, but we are going to have some victories that come from it. And until we share our heartache, we can't make a change in our nation. And it's going to be a two-part show. It's going to be part one and part two. And it's about someone who lost a beloved wife in the hospital, and she didn't have COVID. So on today's episode, we are talking about the sinister plots that were happening in the hospitals. And I don't want you to think, oh, I'm so anti-doctor, I'm so anti-this. I'm anti all of those corrupt people that forced the hand of so many people and caused a lot of death. Okay, so there was an evil agenda that got perpetrated on you and me and everybody else. And that's what I'm upset about. So on today's show, it's a heavy show. We talk to one man who shares the steps and the things that happened in his life. And we're hoping to make a change. We can come together and we can all put these people accountable. If we think the government's going to do it, that's not going to happen. You and I have to come together and link arms, and we will win together. So visit me on the website at theambermayshow.com. And if you believe in what I'm doing, consider becoming an angel investor. Donate $5, $10, $100, whatever you think you could contribute to the program. That would be wonderful. I am not sponsored by Big Pharma, so anything you could do would really be a blessing. You can also be a $5 monthly subscriber by going to theambermayshow.locals.com and subscribing there as well. I always add more content to Telegram, so join me on the Telegram channel at The Amber May Show on Telegram. You can find me at True Social at Amber May or Frank Social at Amber May. But coming up next is the story of Kurt's wife.
I'm not as well connected as some, but I was able to get a hold of a couple judges and a few attorneys, but none of them would do it. Not one.
Are you serious?
Not one. As soon as the COVID thing was brought, because that's immediately, they just assumed it was a COVID, whether I would say it wasn't or not. If I could have said, no, she's, you know, got heart disease, they might have done it. But the point was, I got nobody to advance this at all for me that night. And as the night wore on, a friend of mine called me who had heard me on Sean, or not, hadn't heard me, had heard from another friend of ours that she was in the hospital. What was going on? He said, you know what? You need to get an attorney. And I said, oh, I've been calling all day. And he goes, no, look here. I just lost my mom. They took medical power of attorney from me. They would not let her leave. I said, what are you talking about? First of all, why would they do that? And then, how could they get medical power of attorney? It's your mom. And he goes, no, that it's in the small print. When you admit your family member through the emergency room, you give away the right for them to make a decision about the medical treatment. And you don't know it, but if they decide that you're not the proper care, or you're not going to provide the proper care, or there's a threat of physical violence or anything like that, they'll take power of medical attorney.
Yep.
From me, which ties into incentives about how they're compensated so that they can get their stuff done, right?
Let's talk about that for a second, because it was all flipped on its head.
Yeah. So the first thing, and the reason that this medical power of attorney makes a big deal, is because it helps to have people labeled combative. Because again, that physical threat, then, so it's a medical threat, it's a physical threat, it's whatever, and they're going to be the arbiters of who's going to take care of your family member all of a sudden. But yes. Right. So to your point, Amber, yeah.
It was medically incentivized for them to kill your loved one than to heal them. Yeah. Because what they did is they were getting bonuses for admitting for COVID. Okay. Then they got bonuses if you put them on remdesivir. Then they got a bonus if they vented your loved one. Then they got a bonus if it was a COVID death. It was all backwards. They should have got a bonus if they healed
getting them out of there in 2 days
patient and then got them out of the hospital. Okay, let's incentivize our hospitals to heal our patients, not incentivize our hospitals to kill our patients. Yeah. But that's how the government did it. They incentivized to kill the people. It was like Auschwitz. It was like the concentration camps, you know.
Yeah.
You go so to the barbaric. Hospital, you think you're gonna be fine, but then like they thought the Jews were gonna get a shower, but then they got gas chambered. It was like the exact same thing. And then remdesivir failed the medical trials, failed the Ebola trial, it failed medical trials. It was an EUA only allowed from emergency use authorization when ivermectin won the Nobel Peace Prize, was used in a very used all over the world and hardly had any side effects, very cheap. But they didn't give that to anybody because why? Because Fauci and the people behind it were going to get paid a lot of money. George Soros, I believe, if memory serves me correct, owns the rights or owns the business that manufactures remdesivir, if memory serves me. And so all the people that were getting paid, it's just disgusting. You follow the money.
Right.
And so what I would encourage people to do, because I was already questioning vaccines before COVID even hit, and COVID solidified my questioning of vaccines, in all vaccines, childhood vaccines, regular vaccines. In the description, I hope everybody will watch my presentation that I did on childhood vaccines because it applies to adult vaccines. So in the description, I want you to click on that link. Also, go to my website, theammermayshow.com, click on childhood vaccines. I have so much information on childhood vaccines. And one thing we've learned out of the childhood vaccines is the CDC will lie to physicians in order to push whatever medical agenda. So we found out with the MMR vaccine, it did cause autism among kids, and they destroyed documents. They lied to the physicians that it did not when it actually did. And there's a documentary about the MMR vaccine causing autism. We have an autism rate that is explosive in our nation. It used to be like 1 in 250,000 or something like that. And now it's like 1 every 3,000 or something. I can't remember the exact numbers. I have to go back to my website and look at it. But I will tell you, they don't test for cancer. They don't test to see if it causes infertility. They don't test to see if it changes your genes. There's very little testing, honestly, that goes through.
Right.
From what I can tell, they will put poison inside those vaccines that cause neurological issues, and they're not held accountable because of the 1986 act that happened under President Ronald Reagan. So they are indemnified from getting sued. And so you who has been, or anyone who's been vaccine injured, cannot sue the manufacturers. It's the perfect business model.
Right.
Drano and every vaccine.
Right.
Make thousands upon millions of dollars and no one can touch me.
I have a very good friend named Kelly Burkhart here in Arizona who is on the front lines of this battling. They were affected by a vaccine injury on their boy. And her and I have spent countless hours talking about this since this occurred for me. And I can't, she's someone that would be worthy of visiting with Amber. She's on the front lines doing all she can. A mom that's just very limited resources, and you know, and
in terms of,
I will. But my point is, you're exactly right. There's so many people out there who have experienced this like that, and they don't, you know, for all of us, there's a sense of trust amongst some of those people that just doesn't belong there anymore. But to your point about the incentive plan, about incentivizing people to kill rather than treat, I've said that 100 times, at least, you know, 10 times in different interviews. But you answer this question. How often have you had an insurance claim where the insurance company paid you in full or more than you asked for? 90% of the time, the insurance company argues with you over everything.
Yep.
If you got a roof, if your roof or fence is damaged, or your garage door is damaged, or you have a flood or whatever in your house, they're going to moan and cry and argue about everything. And then by the time they do pay you, it'll probably be what you had coming a little bit, but it won't be the full value and whatever of what you're supposed to get. It'll be a negotiated amount of money, right? Mm-hmm. But they will argue. They're not going to write a check. However, isn't it weird that in the COVID era, insurance companies were incentivizing payments for that kind of treatment and not arguing about it. So outside of the incentive strategy for doing particular remdesivir ventilation, label them COVID death, they're reimbursing hospitals at 120 and 150% of what they're billing for. Why is that? How'd that happen? Who organized that? Who authored that? What meeting took place that got a bunch of insurance companies to sit around and go, hey, you know what? We'll pay you more than we normally would ever pay for anything. Yeah, no problem at all. I know that remdesivir only costs $12, but you can go ahead and charge $36,000 and we'll help you we'll get you reimbursed for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these things as you dig into this, just, you know, who authored the incentive program to begin with? Who called up all the CEOs of all the hospitals in America? Cleveland Clinic didn't decide to change a business model overnight. They got shareholders and they're a multi-billion dollar organization. That someone had a phone call that said, hey, this is what we're going to do. And you're going to change your revenue model going forward, starting tomorrow. If you're the CEO, me, I'm going to say, oh, no, I'm not. I have shareholders to answer to. And I have a particular model that I know works. I have kidney and cancer and brain surgeries and all these things we do. I'm not changing anything. I like the way we do it. And but then they say, oh, no, you are going to, and you're going to agree to it. How'd that happen? Who organized that? That didn't happen by osmosis. How did all the sheriffs around the country all of a sudden become the law enforcement for these hospitals and agree that that wasn't a one by one deal? That was a leadership. Somebody at the highest level decided to get in touch with these guys and they decided to acknowledge it and go forward with it. Because when you talk to these sheriff people and some of these law enforcement guys, most of them don't want to do what they were doing.
They didn't want to do what they were doing.
There's a whole pecking order. I've got 8 or 10 things that I'll send you, but I'm going to tweet them out today again to Elon, Matt Taibbi, and Tucker Carlson. But that
Tucker Carlson won't be able to help you because he's tied to Fox, who is getting sponsored by what? Big Pharma.
I realize that.
The show isn't sponsored by Big Pharma. This one.
Yeah. So the problem, but the challenge. So you're right. And the as we get to finish Tammy's story here, but the truth is, someone needs to ask these questions at a high level. And until the major people will take on that task, like Matt Taibbi and Musk and those guys are doing today in the Twitter files, and that there's a plethora of evidence. So the questions I just asked, I guarantee you there's some file somewhere within an email chain or a Twitter deal where somebody had that conversation. Just like when Fauci tried to hide the email that he was, they were going to go against the Barrington Declaration. Mm-hmm. You know, that email, when they got it out, it was all blacked out. Well, now we know what it really said. It said, hey, make these guys look like trash. They're all, don't let them say this. We need to go down this road and get 50 people to agree with us. Would you please? So I know that this exists. We just have
and
to get somebody.
And not only that, but they lied in medical journals. They put fake documents in medical journals. Yeah. I mean, it was so planned out and it was years. This happened under,
I agree.
My research has shown that this started under the Obama administration. I'm not saying he's the one who planned it, but during that time frame is when the creation of the COVID virus began in North Carolina, Chapel Hill under Richard Barrett. So it started here in the United States and then eventually offshore to China, but it started here in the United States. This whole thing's been planned. Look at Event 201. I mean, to the T, everything that was said and done.
I completely agree with you. They're going through this myself personally so take away my logic hat and my reason hat for a minute. And as we went through this, you know, from a human and emotional perspective, just dealing with what was going on, as this advanced to day four, we've got a treatment plan and a doctor that's going to take her. They've acknowledged that they received the transfer request. They communicated it to me verbally. That night they said, we'll get somebody to you, even though no one's going to be available, you know, as usual, we'll get someone to talk to you. Next morning comes, or that in the middle of the night, which was beginning to be difficult for me. I'm clearly not sleeping. My wife has her phone. I have mine. And, you know, whenever the bell would go off or the phone would ring, I would, you know, be very, very nervous about what was going on and uncomfortable. But she sent me a text at around 2 o'clock in the morning. And she said, Curtis, don't be mad at me. They just put me on high flow oxygen. I feel better. And they said that it's going to speed up my recovery. So she said, I don't know what to do, but I feel better. And I can't send a text back that says, you know, anything other than supportive and loving. So that's exactly what I did. And I said, I'll see you soon. And she asked me to bring her comb.
Hey, I'm going to get to that thought in just a second, but right now I'm going to take a quick break.
When you have your holiday, you could get the Beloved Cheesecakes. They're so delicious. I'm so excited. We have family over. We're going to enjoy this wonderful, delicious cheesecake. And if you use promo code Amber, you could save some money at checkout.
It was so delicious. I was only going to have one piece. But I had her cut it. I had her cut the piece just like the sliver. And I got to have three pieces.
What did you think about the cheesecake?
I loved it. It was really rich, really yummy. I had the chocolate, and it was very, very good. And I really appreciate you that we got to eat some. Thank you.
Hey, so when it's the next celebration in your household, or you have company coming over, or you just have a craving for cheesecake, make sure you visit belovedcheesecake.com. Use promo code AmberMay at checkout to save some money. That's belovedcheesecakes.com. Remember, promo code Amber at checkout.
Hello, this is Tanya Joy from Beauty for Ashes, and you are on The Amber May Show. Stay tuned.
We all like to support veterans and veteran businesses, so I want you to check out the CommandersArtist.com. His artwork is phenomenal, very patriotic. I think you're going to like it. And when you're at CommandersArtist.com, if you use my name, Amber, you're going to save some money at checkout. So you can support a veteran-owned business that also supports the Amber May Show, and you get a discount at the same time. It's a win-win situation for everybody. General Flynn loves him, and he's a great friend to me. So visit thecommandersartist.com today. Use promo code Amber and save some money at checkout.
You are listening to the Amber May Show, and now we return to the show already in progress.
So that next morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, we called to find out what was going on. I'd gotten dressed and was ready to go, even though I couldn't see her till 2 o'clock. I made a point to put on my office clothes, and I was preparing for a date to see my wife. As I was driving to the hospital, I decided to call in and get her vitals and all that stuff, so my kids didn't have to. And they said, the nurse said, oh, she's fine, blah, 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 blah. Gave me, rattled off all these numbers. And I don't know half of what the numbers mean. I knew a couple of them, if they got to a particular level, it was bad. And if they got under a level, it was good. So I just was, you know, that's all I cared about. I hung up the phone, and I had dialed my son and just gotten him on the phone when a call came back from the hospital again, or a call came from the hospital this time. And I said, I told him, hold on, I'm going to pick up. It's the hospital. And it was a young lady. She asked me if I was Curtis Bay. Yes, I am. She said, can you come back to the hospital? Can you come back to the hospital? I go, I haven't been there yet. They go, oh, can you come? I said, yeah, of course. What's going on? They said, well, we just need you to come to the hospital. They want to talk to you. And I said, who's they? Who wants to talk to me? And I'm driving. And they said, well, the nursing staff just wants to talk to you.
They don't want to tell you on the phone.
No. I go, is everything okay? They said, yeah, fine. They just want to talk to you. I said, okay, I'm on my way. Well, I did a U-turn, told my son I'm going back, and we're all freaking out. Like, why? They've never called us. What's going on? I just talked to her at 2 o'clock in the morning.
This is what happened to my mom. She got that phone call. You know, she had left the hospital knowing my dad's not doing so good, and went home for a few hours, and then they got the phone call. I think you need to come back to the hospital.
So I roar back there. I'm panicking, obviously. By the time I get to the floor where they let me in at, and I'm still being escorted by security, by the way. I get to the floor where they let me in at, the nursing table where all the nurses gather. There's, you know, six or eight of them standing around. They're having fun doing their thing. The rest of the corridor is filled with all these people that look like they were in Chernobyl. But when you walk up, they have, you know, all these protocols about where you can stand and what you have to put on and who you can talk to and all this crap. So I finally get the attention of somebody who I tell them I'm here to see Tammy. They had asked me to come back. They come back. They go, oh, yeah, let me get the nurse. So this nurse comes out, who by now is, you know, another nurse that I don't know the name of. This guy's name is Scott.
Have you seen any nurse more than once?
Nothing more than the first day. No.
Whoa.
So that's important. because contract nurses is part of this protocol, but the he says, oh yeah, I was just in there. She was fine. I go, oh, did I talk to you about her? Yeah. He goes, you talked to me. Yeah. I'm Scott, the guy that told you her vitals. All I go, okay, well, why am I back? He goes, I don't know. Hold on a second. This is her nurse, supposedly. He goes back and goes into her room, comes back out and goes, oh, she's not in her room. Look, where's she? Hold on. And I'm like, I'm physically going, what is going on? How do you not know where my wife is? Why are you calling me? What is going on? He says, hold on. Oh, she's down in ICU. Let's go down there. And I'm freaking out. Like, what is she doing in ICU?
How she fell dramatically. Like, she went dramatically from the time you left her the day before. And now
she didn't though, Amber. That's the story. So remember, she hasn't tested positive for COVID yet. Right. She had a little bit of a breathing challenge at the very beginning. She felt good with some antibiotics, IV, and oxygen. We had a transfer request in on the 3rd. They didn't honor it. The 4th, they raised her to high flow in the middle of the night on the 3rd day. On the 4th day, now they all of a sudden she's in ICU in that morning. So after 10 o'clock, now all of a sudden it's 11 o'clock, she's in ICU. He escorts me down there. I get in there and I'm losing my shit because,
I would lose it too.
There's a white coat dude, young guy, probably late 30s, early 40s, pulmonologist guy I've never met, never seen, never talked to. And there's like six, gowned nurses all standing around in this room around my wife. And she's in this bed and she's not even on high flow now. She's just back to nasal. And I noticed that immediately when I walked in, because she had said she'd gotten put on high flow that night. So when I saw that, I was like, well, is that high flow? I thought that looked different, but okay. Well, walked in and I said, what's going on? And he says, we need to intubate her. I wasn't very kind or anything. I'm just very, clinical. And I said, okay, can you tell me what's going on? How'd we get here? I just talked to the guys this morning, blah, blah, blah. I look at her, she's teared up, but she's not like scared, teared up, crying, but she's nervous. And he says that we got to do this and we need to do it now. And I said, why do we have to do it now? I don't understand. Why is the urgency? Can you tell me more about this? Mm-hmm. They beat around the bush. Just were really difficult to talk to, wouldn't communicate very well at all, not kind. And so I said, let me talk to my wife for a little bit. So I talked to her and she got choked up and started crying a little bit, just said, I'm really nervous. I don't know what to do. But she goes, I said, what have they told you? And she said, they said, I just need this, that my lungs need to rest. This is the story they tell everybody. My lungs need to rest. And this will be the best way for me to recover quickly. So that night before was high flow. Now it's all of a sudden ventilation for her to get the best chance at recovery because her lungs need to rest, supposedly. When he comes
my lungs need to rest. They're made to breathe every day.
And they that's one of the reasons resting. Why that very first day, at least I knew we didn't want to have her forced oxygen because everything I had understood to that point, and I didn't understand a lot, but I understood that wasn't a good thing to do. So when this happened, we were, I turned to her and I said, babe, what do you want to do? She goes, well, if it's the best thing for me to do, I want to be around. So we decided that was the best thing for her to do based on what they were telling us. And so I prayed with her. I got my boys on the phone. They talked to her. She was so lucid and normal. There wasn't any, she didn't have fever. There wasn't anything going on there at all. And I asked the doctor when he came back in, I said, if this was your mom or your sister, your wife, your daughter, whatever, he said, I would do it in a second. I go, can we have, 20 minutes or an hour? Can we do it tomorrow? He said, nope, we have to do it today. I said, okay. Tammy and I prayed, I kissed her and I walked out of the room. my son was on his way. So he raced there. He didn't make it in time to see his mom get before she was unconscious. He made it right just about a minute or two after that. But we stood in the hallway and wept, tried to figure out a way that, we were going to be able to navigate this now, because this was way off of the scale. This was way more than we had anticipated from 3 days prior. She was going to be out of there. She was going to get some fluids. She didn't have COVID. And we were going to get her transferred, even if she did. All of those things had gone down the toilet. So this starts a whole new transition, because once you're in the ICU, you only get 15 minutes of visitation, and you can't go in the room for the most part there. You have to look outside the window. They write all the stuff on the window that tells you whatever's going on. And if you don't know what it is, you know, there's no one really there to help you. These nurses rotate in and out. So for a couple of days, we were going in doing that every morning and every evening, still checking on her vitals. The couple of the nurses would be kinder than others, but others would be just completely clinical and just basically, here's what her numbers are and I can't give you any more. When we'd ask to speak to somebody else, they would always say, well, the pulmonologist will be on tomorrow or whatever, but there was never a time when it would be when you're there. So if you ask them to have them call you back, they might call you back, but it wasn't a chance to have a discussion. It was just a chance for them to tell you again how dumb you are. And, you know, we're doing all we can. A couple days go by doing this, and the maybe 3 days, going on four days. I'm, again, still not sleeping. This is killing our family. I mean, we're up, all of us are just don't know what to do with this. She was so healthy, just shouldn't be in this spot. So we're all doing, you know, what we can, and we're praying, and people are really engaged. I get a FaceTime video from her phone, and she was on the phone with my youngest son, who had gone down there that morning. We decided he would be the one to go for the 15 minutes. And when he got there, just shortly after that, they FaceTimed me. They'd taken her off the ventilator, and she was recovering in CCU. She was on 7 liters of oxygen again. After that, we were so joyful and thankful and grateful that this was over, that, you know, she was going to be coming home. We didn't have to go through this anymore. And thank God for, even though it was all painful and all of those things, we were there. We were finally going to get her home. That night, she rested, and we didn't want to bother her with texts or phone calls or anything like that. She clearly needed some rest now after going through that. The next day, she texted me and told me she was doing fine. She was eating breakfast, or she was having an Ensure drink, but her throat, she had a sore throat, as you might imagine. We talked a little bit. I said I'd come see her. I came and saw her. She was really fatigued. I was there for maybe 20 minutes, and she said, and now I could stay for 2 hours, by the way, in CCU. She said she was really fatigued and said, she said, babe, do you care if I just turn over and go to sleep? And I said, no, I'll stay here. And I stayed there for the whole time and held her hand and visited a little bit with myself and prayed for her. Left that night. It was day 12 of her being there. Day 12 of her being there. I came down to see her again in the afternoon, spent a couple hours with her. Pulmonologist came in, hospitalist came in. Everything's fine, seems to be on track to her getting out of there, but we're really struggling with why it's taking so long to send her home. She was on 7 liters after the day she got out of there. Why are we still going through this? They didn't have a real explanation, but we're not doctors. And at this point, we're just desperate to get her home and feel like any minute they're going to call and say, come get her. And so we were, you know, doing everything at the home. I had the house cleaned 15 times in that 2 day period. I had the cars completely professionally detailed and chemically treated. I'd bought her masks and got oxygen at the house. I was, you know, ready for her to be home and take care of whatever we need to take care of. At 1:48 in the morning, my phone rang and it went off with a text, and it said, babe, can you come get me? And I picked up the phone and called her and said, what's going on? I can't come get you. They won't let me in. What's going on? And I could hear all the oxygen going off in the background. So they had the high flow going, they had everything going in the background, and I could hear the nurse and somebody else arguing about her treatment. And she had me on speaker, clearly. And I said, can I talk to the nurse? And so the nurse leaned over, and her name was Holly. And she said, Curtis, she's having a panic attack. And she called it defib or something like that. I don't know what the term was at the time. I still don't understand all the terminology. I understand it, but wasn't part of my lexicon. So she said something about it. And I said, well, what are you doing? And she said, well, we're going to get her taken care of here. And I said, well, just keep me on the speaker. Let me talk to her. She's, you know, I've been 40 years of you know, walking her, talking her off the ledge if she gets a little bit of a panic attack or anxiety. She didn't like being in elevators, but that was the only thing she didn't. She didn't have any other issues. So I said, just let me talk to her. So they kept me on speaker and I could hear them arguing. The respiratory therapist that was in there was arguing with Holly about venting her again, because she the policy was that if she went to this particular scale in their protocol, she had to be ventilated. She could no longer be treated that way. So Holly is, I can hear her saying, no, her husband is talking to her. He's, look, her blood, her heart rate's coming down. No, we're not doing that. No, they went back and forth. And I asked Holly, I said, please just stop arguing. Can you guys go outside? Please just leave her alone. Got quiet for a minute. And I'm just talking with Tam and she's telling me she's very uncomfortable. She feels like she's got an elephant on her chest. She said, I don't know why this is happening. I don't understand this. I was doing so well. And I'm like, I don't either, babe, but we prayed, we hung out, we talked for an hour.
I wonder if they popped one of her lungs.
Well,
and it needed to be inflated.
So she, in the autopsy and things like that, that I ended up doing afterwards, I've learned a lot, but the, that moment, I talked her down. She got down to a place where Holly felt comfortable and she had no more interruptions from this respiratory therapist. Because apparently there's something, an alarm went off when she hit a particular target. And that's what brought the respiratory therapist in and then started this whole process of you need to be ventilated again.
Your lungs can only take so much oxygen to go through them.
I called my kids. It was 2-3 in the morning by now, almost 3:30. And I got the Holly chick on the phone and she was at least kind enough to say, look, Curtis, they're not going to let you in, but I'll get you in at 7 a.m. I'll meet you down at the front, whatever, at 7, and you can come in and, you know, talk to her. I said, I just need to be there to talk her down. She'll be fine. I go, put me on a treatment plan. I don't care. Joking, but serious. And she said, I'll get you in at 7. So I got there at 7. And I have video of, you know, just touching her and watching her heart rate go down. So I spent that whole morning with her. The pulmonologist came back in. He said, you know, we're going to get you back up to that other floor. They have more, they have better treatment and better attention and blah, blah, blah. And at the time, I didn't care. I just wanted her out of there. So the hospitalist came back in and I said, what's going on? How can this be? We've followed every rule that you guys said. We've done everything that you've asked. You didn't transfer. You haven't given her the stuff that we wanted. She was supposed to be going home in a day after doing this. And now you're going to transfer her back up to this other room and you don't really have a plan. He goes, well, I think she'll get better attention up there. And, you know, she can come out of this. It's just going to take her a little bit longer. She's a warrior, blah, blah, blah. I said, what happened? I mean, this is just too much of a freak. What happened? She was on 7 liters and then all of a sudden she's on freaking high flow again. And they're arguing about ventilating her. And he goes, well, I don't know. He goes, you know, we did stop the steroid protocol. And I'm like, what steroid protocol? What are you talking about? And I'd heard it before. I just didn't put it together, but they give them a low dose of some steroid pack. And it's a child dose. If they gave them the real dose, it would actually help them, but they give them enough to just make them, you know, level off a little bit, but not. So anyway, the point was, it was helping her apparently, because it's a 10-day protocol, by the way, another protocol, 10-day protocol. And at the end of that 10 day, it doesn't matter whether you're succeeding with it or not, they cut you off. So she had clearly affected her. When I said, well, this clearly is cause and effect. And he goes, well, we can't say that. And I go, oh, you don't have to, but I'm saying it. So can you get her back on it? And he goes, well, yeah, I'll get her back on it. I go, well, get her on it right now. And he goes, well, it has to go through approval. It has to go through our pharmacy, blah, blah, blah. I go, well, can you do it now? I mean, you got a computer. You guys do all this stuff real quick on the computer all the time. Can you just request it and get it done and get it back in her? And he said, well, yeah, well, I'll get started on it right now. He left the room. They transfer us to that room upstairs. I go with her. I'm
surprised that I thought you weren't going to have her up there. I was surprised. Oh,
Amber, I didn't think anything about it at all either. I just, by the grace of God, I was a ghost for a couple hours. No one noticed me and didn't think about it while I was up there. And I made it.
I'm surprised you're even in the hospital, honestly, because I know what a prison it was like.
I made a point to hide in the bathroom. on that, good. After that, I made a point to lay down on the floor beside her bed, the couch. I did everything I could to make sure that I didn't cause any problems. And if someone was coming or I knew they were coming, I made a point to get out of there if I could, or hide if I could. But usually the nurses were such robots that they had no idea when they walked in, they didn't go, well, you're not supposed to be here. They didn't even realize it. So I'm holding Tam's hands. We're talking, we're getting through this. She's in and out. She's tired as heck. She's on high flow. Her poor body was just riddled, her arms and hands with the black and blue marks where they were taking her blood. And she wasn't eating. I don't know how they were feeding her, but she wasn't eating. That next morning, I spent the night there. I convinced the girl that came in, I don't know her name because none of them knew us either. Walked in and I just said, hey, I'm going to lay on the couch. I won't bother anybody. I said, if it's a problem, you can have me escort it out, but I won't cause any problem. She said, oh, I'm not going to say anything as long as you don't cause any problems. So I just laid there covered up, held her hand the entire night. The next morning we woke up, the pulmonologist and the hospitalist came in. I was present. They looked at me weird, but didn't say anything. And she was sitting upright, great attitude. She'd had her blood taken. She was full of herself. I was on the phone, FaceTiming my boys, saying, she's going to come home. And she was laughing, saying, I am going to come home. And then my oldest boy, Cal, said, Brandon and Kason are really excited to see you, Mom. And she started crying. She said, that's the only reason I'm fighting this hard. Those will be, I want to see those kids. And so the pulmonologist said, how are you feeling so good? You're not supposed to be feeling good. Based on our numbers and what you're, the data we're seeing, you shouldn't be feeling this good. And she said, I don't know, doc, but I'm going home. That was day 13. Me and her laughed. We joked. She said to me a couple times, Curtis, I've given up hope. I'd lost all hope in this. I didn't think I was going to be able to go home. I feel better today than I have felt, since I got here. And she hadn't had the steroid injection yet. The hospitalist came back in later that afternoon. Me and her played some Sudoku and some games, card games, and laughed a little bit. She was fatigued. So we had planned so that she would rest. And we were hoping that this sort of strategy we had for that day would get her home the next morning, that they would finally release her. So we were focusing on making sure she had plenty of rest and her oxygen was being managed better. From our side, we couldn't guarantee what was going to happen, but I was staying there at night to do everything I could to just eliminate any riffraff. But
that was a miracle in itself. Yeah,
it was. And the hospitalist came back in. I said, did you get her back her steroids yet? And he said, no, I haven't been able to yet. And I go, what's the holdup? How can you guys, we're in the hospital. You're the guy. How is this a holdup? And he goes, yeah, I'm getting it done. It has to go through our policy approval board. Then it has to go to the whatever. And then it has to go to the pharmacist. He goes, I've already signed off on it, but should happen in the next couple hours. That was day 13. We're probably around noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He asks her when the last time she had a bowel movement was, and she says she wasn't sure, but he looks at the chart with the technician that's sitting next to him. He goes, oh, it's been like 5 days or so. He goes, let's get her taken care of for that. So they apparently, they scheduled that, which, it never happened, by the way. But that night we had a plan, Tammy and I, where that she would go to bed when she was fatigued, finally tired, and they'd done all their stuff they were finally going to do. And I would be here again. I could see in the middle of the night, both nights that I'd stayed there, that she, when her body would start to get anxiety ridden or she felt, I could tell when that would happen. So I would caress her like I would, and I would talk to her, and, even though she was sleeping, it would help her. You need the human body and soul needs that. So
plus she felt safe because you were there.
Oh, totally. Yep. And I wasn't good at a lot of stuff, but that was one thing. She felt safe and secure, and she never had to worry about anything. But the I hadn't done a very good job on this one. That night was our plan to just get some rest. We'll get you up in the morning. She had breakfast and she had lunch that day, and she ate real meals, which was the first time that I'd seen that. Like I said, she was herself. I FaceTimed the boys. Everybody was super excited. This was going to happen. It was clear next day she was going home. There was no way anything was going to keep that from happening. That morning, just a little before 7 a.m. the next morning, this is day 13, 14. They came in, new technician, again, as usual. By the, she had, in 20 days, she had 22 different nurses.
Wow, and, that's
insane. And over half of them were contract nurses from outside the country. Not dissing anybody, but I'm saying that's part of the protocol. When you can pay someone a flat fee for being in there, they can't argue and push back about that, how they're treating the patient. They're going to do, I asked the doc, one of the nurses, I said, can you this or that? And he goes, oh no, my job is to just do what the doctor leaves on these orders. I have to complete the order, fill the order. I said, so you don't get any, you can't make a determination about how to treat her, or you can't, you know, they kept wanting her to be prone or this or that. And we would push back like, nah, it's not working for her. Every time she does, it skyrockets, just, you know, we'll ease her into it or whatever. They would always say, no, we have to do it. And I had to push back those last couple of days and say, no, we're not doing that because it changes things. And I don't want to go through that. I can't watch her do that. So no. But the point was, these guys rotate. They have no idea. I said, and the one guy that was there at night, one night, I said, can you be here tomorrow? You appreciate your care and your, you know, communication and all that. He said, yeah, I'll check, but I don't think so. I have to go to Atlanta. Another girl that I said, I like, you know, can you stay? She said, no, I have to be in Oregon. These people are from Spain, Italy, oh. Germany, Brazil. They're all over the place. But so this new nurse comes in that's going to take her blood, and she's totally out. And so I leaned over and whispered in her ear that I said, hey, babe, they need to take your blood this morning. And she started to roll over and wake up, and her eyes got the size of 50 cent pieces. And she said, I'm having a panic attack. Can you please help me, Curtis? So I started talking to her and trying to calm her down. And we focused on each other, and I held her hand, and her heart rate was up to 168, and she was coming apart. Her little body was just completely coming apart. The nurse that was there that morning came in and immediately threw the red flag that she was on that. The next step was ventilating again. She was legitimately panicking now. She was scared. She could hear all the beeps and buzzers and alarms going off, and it was making her more nervous. I asked him to turn everything off. You know, you guys can monitor it, but can you please turn it off? No one would help. It just completed to escalate to a point where the hospitalist, the pulmonologist, and an ICU nurse all of a sudden was back in the room, and they said, she's going to die. We have to get her ventilated again and give her body a chance. So I walked her down to the emergency or the ICU room together. We prayed the whole time. I told my boys what was going on, and they were in the mindset that they couldn't understand, but Dad, you have to do whatever you have to do to save her. So I walked down with her. We went back into the same room that she was in earlier, a couple of days before. They ventilated her again. And 2 days went by. The second day at 2 o'clock in the morning, these early morning calls like this are not good from the hospital. And the nurse that was caring for her at the time said, Curtis, we might have to do some surgery. She's not doing well, and I'm losing it. Haven't slept in 15 days. And
of course.
I said, of course you're going to do surgery. Whatever you have to do, do it. And she said, yeah, we're trying to get a hold of the surgeon right now. And I lose it on the phone. I'm like, how? You're in the ICU and you don't have a surgeon that's right there that you can do this? I mean, I don't, what is going on? And she said, no, just be, you know, calm down. We're getting a hold of somebody, you know, I'll have a response for you in a few minutes. She called me back a few minutes later. In the meantime, I'm on the phone with my boys, telling them what's going on. I said, I'm going down there, you guys, and you need to meet me down there. So, because I don't know what is happening. So it's about 10 minutes to three. I show up in ICU and my boys are right there. The surgeon meets us in the hallway and says, she has something leaking in her cavity. And I at the time, I don't know if he said air or fluid or whatever, but it was clearly, this was bad. She had something leaking in her cavity that they needed to do surgery on to repair. The problem was she was laying prone, and in order for them to do a scan to determine where the leak was coming from, they had to turn her over. They couldn't do the scan the way she was. If they turned her over, he said she would stop breathing. So there was no alternatives. We asked what we could do, what he could do. And he said, there's really nothing we can do. She's going to die. We can't do the surgery because we can't do a scan. And if we turn her over to do a scan to find out how to do the surgery or where, she's going to die. So he said, it's best that, you guys take the time now and spend it with her, because this is probably not going to end well. So I stayed with her for the next hour or so and prayed and begged and did everything else I could do, caressed her. But that was the last time we were together with her. They pronounced her dead that on the 20th of January this last year. And they didn't want to do an autopsy. They said there was no need. I hired a forensic autopsy group here in Arizona to do a forensic autopsy. I hired a forensic toxicology group to do a toxicology report at the same time. Those take longer. I've gotten some preliminary info back on the toxicology. I haven't gotten it yet complete. I'm still missing documents from Banner to help sort of align some of the treatment and things like that occurred. But she had, there were some substances in her body that I won't say right now, but there were some things, there's a lot of things that happened to her. She had some punctures in a couple areas. The feeding tube wasn't inserted properly. The feeding tube wasn't inserted properly on either the first or second occasion. Don't know, but there she had a puncture, which again, she hadn't had her bowels cleaned out for 5 days. When they called and said she has something leaking into her system, all of this stuff just was, there's so many things that in terms of neglect and poor mistreat, all of those things line up like a Christmas tree. But none of that had to occur. None of it. They made a decision based on the incentive strategy and the protocols put in place by our government, our agencies, and the insurance companies and big pharma to treat my wife in a way that would check the box so that they could get paid. They didn't care about healing her or helping her get well. She was a healthy 59-year-old beautiful woman. You've seen pictures of her, Amber. She had living a great life, athletic, no issues. And they chose the best thing to do was to begin the minute they had her in care by isolating her, feeding her with all kinds of poisons and dehydrating her, starving her, poisoning her, not giving her the steroids, ventilating her twice. All of those things all did not have to happen, and they happened because it meant that they could get paid. And the other side of that is, one of the ways that we saw a big push where a lot of nurses and doctors were fired for not getting the vaccine. I think there were probably, let's say, 50% of all nurses and doctors that were fired during that period were legitimately fired by the organization because they didn't have the vaccine. And so therefore the hospital took advantage of being able to get rid of those people. But I'll bet
they were probably bucked the system.
Well, I was just gonna say, I'll bet you that there were vaccinated people in that mix too that just were pushing back, and they took advantage of the opportunity to say, no, we're not having that in this hospital. You guys are, and so they took advantage of the opportunity to build the case in the media to say, we're getting rid of all those terrible unvaccinated nurses and doctors, when reality, they wanted to get rid of anybody that was pushing back and arguing. I had a conversation with, I wish I could remember that Dr. Doggone it. She was in Houston. Wonderful.
Dr. Stella Emanuel?
No, Bauer or, anyway, I was on a panel with, on Steve, Kirsch's show. And she, Dr. Bauer, I think it's Dr. Bauer from Houston. And she was treating people in the Houston hospital, her own way. And she didn't have a single death and no one was going, she was treating them with, hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, lots of vitamin C, high doses of vitamin C and some other stuff. 2,200 patients, never had one of them die, never had one of them need ventilation, nothing. And she was fired by email and made a public. She went out and stood in front of the hospital and did a big PR deal. She ended up, and she was accurate. She's testified before Congress. When all this happened, I sent a note to Ron Johnson because he was the only politician that I knew that was trying to do anything. But he, you know, even that's part of the challenge that we face. But he sent me back a personal note that said, I'm sorry, Curtis, you know, there's probably 500,000 to 600,000 people that have been treated this way and are now labeled COVID death. I ask a lot of questions after I started getting into this about, you know, at the time, how come the West was really the only part of the globe where we had high death rates? How is it that India has, you know, so many billion, 1.4 billion people, and they only have 500,000 deaths in a squalor, poverty-stricken, people laying on top of each other in ditches in some areas? How is it that they only have 500,000 people dead, but yet we have millions dead? How come Nigeria? How come all these other countries, Switzerland, all these places, but yet in the West, we have all these people dead? And it comes back to the protocols.
Yeah, what we were finding out is our government was hoarding hydroxychloroquine. And then, like you said, they minimized the amount of people that could get monoclonal antibodies. So your government was purposely working against you. This is how they were going to usher in the New World Order or the Fourth Industrial Revolution, however you want to say it. And this is not a tinfoil hat. Look at his story. Nope. Look what goes, like, if you listen to what they say with the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and all them, it was a way to depopulate the earth because they fully, in their religious beliefs, they really think that this is what they need to do. And then it ushers in the Fourth Industrial Revolution because they could put nanotechnology in you. They want to track and trace. They want to have surveillance under the skin. This is what they say. They have the 5G towers everywhere to build the smart cities that are across the United States. And how they can track you and trace you is through this nanotechnology. And so they put all this stuff with the vaccine passports in place. I mean, the whole thing was so organized so well. And I do want to be fair on my show. What happened to your wife is not okay. But I will say this. There were good doctors and good nurses. They got fired. Jody O'Malley was one of the first nurses that I knew that came out, and she was on the brink of getting fired. She was able to save her job because she didn't violate anything ethical. Well, if she still works there, I don't know if she quit or not. But then I talked to Dr. Eric Napudi, and he has a $1 billion lawsuit or a substantial amount of lawsuit against them for trying to do natural remedies. And so the doctors, just like the doctor you saw, who was trying to treat her patients in a right ethical manner, got fired. They were picking out doctors who were doing it, and it made doctors afraid. Natural humanity will, when they have fear, they don't make good choices, and they tower, and then they concede to whatever the terrorist organization is.
Yep.
So there was doctors that were terrified of losing their livelihood that provides for a family. And you said it yourself on this program that you know, a man carries so much weight on him when it comes to his family, and you felt like the protector. And so these doctors do too. And it scared them. They're going to
lose their job. There's also another rational observation to be made about that is they probably, a lot of these folks that were faced with this, believed that they could still have an impact. So even if they were stuck in the system and they were going to do all they could to fight and battle it. So I don't have our government, the NIH, the NAIA, the pharma people, the COVID cartel, basically, the big insurance companies, the government agencies,
hospital bureaucrats.
The hospital bureaucrats, all of these people had to sit around at some point in some room, you know, whether it was CEOs on one day, pharma on one day, insurance companies on, I don't care. They had to build a strategy that they said, look, these are the things that we want to do. This is the consequences. So the risk reward to those guys was, oh, okay, it doesn't matter. If we get rid of them, good for us because we depopulate whatever. Whatever their agenda was on that side of it, they didn't care. And they knew they had the media, you know, to sell and be the propaganda arm of whatever they were going to try and do. So there was never going to be any real pushback during this period. And if you were, if you did push back, you would be like me and many others, labeled combative. Cops would come. If they wanted to, they could go as far as to ruin your business. They could do anything and everything in your community that they wanted you to, you know, this was a nightmare. And the questions that you and I ask and many people that have gone through this ask, because the other people that look at this go, there's no way, it just didn't happen, couldn't happen. You tell someone that this happened, they go, oh, no, that just couldn't happen.
It happened.
But it happens, and it's still happening. That's the biggest tragedy right now, is it's still happening. So Congress knows all of this. Congress, everybody knows exactly what happened, and yet it's still happening. Major media knows all this. Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, CNN, I don't give a rat's, they all know this, and nobody is going to talk about it. So the only way that this gets escalated and put in a way that the public can look at it rationally and go, oh my God, yeah, is that we have to, somebody has to get to those communications. Those communications that took place, and with Elon Musk releasing all these Twitter files on COVID, whether they're covering it in the release, it's in there. There, we may only see, you know, Matt Taibbi give 10 paragraphs and link 55 or 60 emails, but I promise you, in listening to him talk on his Substack, there's hundreds of thousands of documents and emails that exist that if according to him, you know, the way they search is they just put in a word and a name, and then it filters out a bunch of documents. They go through them and they figure out what they built. So if they're still on their own agenda for the most part, they're saying, yes, there was, you know, there was collusion to do all these things, but they haven't gone to the questions that you and I are asking. Who authored the incentive program?
And here's the bad thing about this whole thing. We have such a captured country. And if we're going to wait for the government to do something, it's not going to happen because our government's captured. So it's going to be people like you and I that have to link arms together and fight this, because that's the only way we're going to win.
Why I'm doing
There's
this.
There's a couple things I want everyone to do, and you need to make this video go viral. It's going to be in a couple part series. I want you to share it and share it and share it and share it. The other thing I want you to do is, if you've lost a loved one, go to 1000widows.org. You don't have to be a wife that lost a husband. I don't care. If you've lost a loved one, go to 1000widows.org and share your story. You're welcome to come on my platform. But I also want to encourage you to put pressure on your state legislators and the Health and Human Services Committee to start doing investigations. Now, that being said, we still know that our government is not what we thought 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. It's a captured country. But we're going to use every means available to us. That means maybe you and others come together and do a class action lawsuit. You can go against companies that forced the jab on people, hospitals who murdered your loved ones. And then we just keep putting pressure on our legislators by linking arms together. Because when we speak up and we link arms, it's a powerful movement. I mean, look at anything throughout the American history. It didn't start from the government fixing everything. No, they're the problem. It started with the people doing something, and it fixed the situations that we're facing. And so there's a lot of things that we can do. There's an organization that we are a part of that just started from Citizens Uniting, and they are going to be a strong arm. And they are going to put a lot of public pressure on elected officials. But people have to start coming together and being united. That's the only way we're to fight this.
Yeah. 100% only way. But there's plenty of information out there now. And Amber has access to it, and other people do on different websites and podcasts about what to do when you get it. And find a concierge nurse. Someone that doesn't have, that won't meet the, or won't care about meeting the particular qualifications for giving monoclonals, if that's the route you decide to go. You know, we learned later that existed. I didn't even know that existed. but have a cash plan where you can pay for that and get someone to come to your house, give you oxygen, give you treatment, whatever you need, and avoid that if you at all costs. Mm-hmm. If you have to go, make sure you have an advocate plan. Look, again, there's lots of people out there, Protocol Kills.
American Frontline Nurses.
There's some great resources out there today that, and you've spoken on them a bunch, Amber.
Well, thank you so much, Curtis, for being so brave, rehashing all those hard memories, but it's going to help someone. And if we can save someone, then it was totally worth doing your story. So thank you so much for coming on the program.
I appreciate it, Amber. I'm happy to support and do whatever I can to help drive more awareness and action so that we can get a broader array of people at a higher level asking some of these same questions.
God bless you and your family.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.